and be seated, everybody. First up is State versus Artuno Perez.
Good morning. I can reserve 3 minutes, please. Nancy Collins here on behalf of Santiago Artuno Perez. The trial court in this case prohibited the defense from saying that another person present at the shooting was the shooter. They couldn't elicit evidence or argue from admitted evidence that pointed the finger at another person present. This broad ruling violated Mr. Artuno Perez's right to present a defense and confront his accusers. The reason the trial court issued this very broad ruling was based on a misunderstanding of case law and other suspect evidence. As our Supreme Court recently explained in Franklin, there is no heightened threshold or different test for admissibility of other suspect evidence. The question is its relevance and admissibility under the rules of evidence generally. The defense is not required to disprove the state's case against the defendant in order to introduce evidence of a third party's guilt. The question is one of relevance, and does it tend to create a doubt about the state's case? As the court said in Franklin, is there some combination of facts or circumstances that point to a non-speculative link between the other suspect and the charged crime? And it's the jury's role to weigh inconsistencies, biases, and determine whether the state met its burden of proof.
Is that a yes or no question? Either there is evidence tending to connect this other suspect to the crime or there isn't. And if it is a yes or no, is that inconsistent with the discretion of the court to rule on balancing the probity?
It's obviously, you know, a case-by-case question of whether that non-speculative link is there. And if the court says there's no, you know, I find it completely, you know, like, you know, the Downs case, you know, or like just the allegation that someone who's a known burglar was in Seattle the night of the burglary occurred, and the court said, no, it's not. You can't then elicit evidence about this other guy. But here, you know, in addition to excluding evidence, there is that bar on argument, which is, you know, very broad and all-encompassing. So here we have a person who's present at the scene who fit the description of the shooter given by the Mr. Castro's girlfriend, who screamed to him, "Don't shoot me, don't shoot me," to Mr. Agnish after the shooting. Mr. Agnish had a gun with him, standing within feet of the complaining witness. There was evidence of animosity towards Mr. Castro's gang and his own strong affiliation with a rival gang. All this evidence, the defense wasn't allowed to introduce any of it or argue inferences from the evidence that would have said this other person present could be the shooter.
Of those things that were set forth in the offer of proof, what therein actually was admitted? Trying to get a handle on what was not allowed in at all and what was actually admitted or came into the case somehow and was not allowed to be argued.
Well, I don't know that any of it was actually admitted, other than there was
some things were, because there was a reason before argument for the colloquy with the court and counsel where defense counsel was saying, well, I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there were some things that came in, notwithstanding the ruling, that he wanted to reference.
Well, the thing that I recall him wanting to reference was the description that Ms. Lascano was the only person who, of the state's witnesses, sorry, who was not, you know, part of the Mr. Agnish's sort of group cohort, that Erica Lascano had given a description that matched Mr. Agnish. And the court said, well, you can elicit that description, but you can't elicit evidence or even argue to the jury that that description matched him, because the court said that would be pointing the finger at him. And my other suspect ruling says you can't do that. And otherwise, I had to offer a proof right here, and I'll look at it again before I get back up. But I don't believe, but most of it went to the various things that gave Mr. Agnish or the jury a reason to discount his testimony based upon a motive and a bias and an actual opportunity to be the shooter having the gun. None of that came in. There was some evidence that a police officer testified during trial about a gun that Mr. Agnish had, and then that was stricken. And the defense was to say, well, you know, you've opened the door now to Mr. Agnish having a gun. We should be allowed to explore that. No, we'll strike that testimony that shouldn't have been allowed, and they weren't ever allowed to get into that evidence, that issue at all.
What is it clear? And if so, where can we locate it? Whether the defense theory was that Mr. Agnish was the shooter, or whether it was just that one of the other people who were closely located nearby may have been the shooter.
Their initial burden of, or their initial memo says it could have been anyone. We know all these three had this motive, but they were plainly focused on Mr. Agnish, who had the gun, and they do say that. And I think that in the October 27th transcript, pages 17 to 21, where they're having that kind of later colloquy, like, you've made this ruling, you know, and then they talk about there that Ms. Lascano identified Mr. Agnish, you know, and he's the person who we're saying, you know, had that opportunity. And in that discussion, they make clear that they want to, that he's their focus point. And again, during, in the middle of Mr. Agnish's testimony, when the defense says, you know, I really asked, like, you to reconsider this ruling here, we really need to be able to get into his motive and biases about Mr. Castro, an opportunity to be the shooter, when he came out, when he testified, and the court again said no, he was the focus point. In their offer of proof, you know, as well, that he was the focal point. So even though they said other people present could have been done it, he was the one who they had evidence about motive and bias and actual opportunity having that gun that the jury never heard about. And it was really otherwise a case only about allegations. There was no corroborating evidence otherwise. It wasn't a strong case for the prosecution, and it was simply the testimony of these witnesses that was the only evidence before them. So based on these facts of this case, it was very prejudicial and would have gone, if nothing else, to the biases and motives of these other witnesses, Mr. Agnish's friends and cohorts, who were potentially covering up for him and in order and framing Mr. Ortuno Perez because of that.
Would a court applying the Franklin test, addressing an offer of proof of animosity, have the discretion to say, yeah, you know, you got some animosity here, but, you know, it's just not very compelling, and I'm going to, in my discretion, I'm going to conclude that isn't, get you over the hump?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, animosity alone, like, you can sort of take little bits of it out of context. I mean, the central link here is the fact that he was present and he had a gun, and then in addition to that, you have reasons to explain why he could have been the shooter. So that's what takes it over the threshold here and makes it improper to not let the defense even argue.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Ann Summers on behalf of the state of Washington. I'm going to focus on the other suspects. Appellate counsel, I think rather astutely, tries to sidestep the abuse of discretion standard here by claiming that the court made a legal error, but the record does not reflect that the court made any sort of legal error or applied the incorrect standard. Unlike Holmes or Franklin, there's no evidence whatsoever that the court factored in the strength of the state's evidence in excluding the evidence, and that argument was never made to the court. The court explicitly said, I've read Downs, which is the 1932 case that still sets forth the standard. I've read Strizhouse, which was the most recent case, again, using the correct standard and excluding evidence, and then the court made its ruling.
Did the court read Franklin?
She did not state that she read Franklin.
Do you know if anybody brought Franklin to the court's attention?
I don't remember if that was cited in any of the briefing. But Franklin does not change the Down standard. What Franklin said is that Judge Rogers misapplied.
Is it your view that something can meet the requirements of the 400 series evidentiary rules, not be excluded from admissibility by the application of any other rule in the codified rules, and still not be admissible because there is something that doesn't meet the doctrine or whatever it is of other suspect evidence?
No. It's my view that the Downs formulation...
So it's simply a matter of, no matter, notwithstanding cases for decades that have talked about other suspect evidence, when it gets down to it, it's just a matter of applying ER 401, 402, and 403 and seeing if this stuff should come in or stay out.
I believe that Downs is a formulation a specific formulation of complying formal.
I don't need to categorize downs in order to ask the question. If you're a trial judge and you properly apply ER 401, 402, and 403,
yes.
Does it even matter if you've read any of these other cases?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Well, if it's so, that and if Franklin makes it clear that it's so,
yes.
That there's nothing special about other suspect evidence. There's no heightened bar. There's no allowable focus on the strength of the opponent's case.
Yes.
It's just about, does it meet the requirements of the 400 series evidentiary rules and not offend the requirements of any other rule in the rules of evidence, then it's admissible.
Well, I don't.
Why would any of these other things matter?
I don't think trial courts should ignore the down standards.
I'm not asking you whether they should ignore the Supreme Court. Obviously,
okay,
we would all agree that we should pay close attention to everything the Supreme Court does.
And the U.S. Supreme Court, which has also approved that standard in Holmes.
But what does that mean to approve that standard? Are you saying then that it's something different than applying ER 401, 402, 403, and the rest?
It means that unless there's a train of facts and circumstances that tend to clearly point to someone else, it's not relevant.
Is that different from just being relevant?
No.
I'm not sure that's the standard anymore.
Do you think, Frank?
The question is whether or not it establishes a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt. That's what we're looking for. We're not looking for whether or not there's a train of evidence that implicates beyond a reasonable doubt some other suspect. It's just whether the evidence establishes a reasonable doubt.
What?
And I think the trial court, from what the trial court said, relied on the extent to which the evidence pointed towards this other person. And I'm not sure that's the correct standard.
Well, I think that's the standard this court applied in Wade in 2015, and also the standard that the court, Division III, applied in Starbuck in 2015 as well. In both of those cases.
You think that's the standard that the Supreme Court applied in Franklin, though?
Well, what the Supreme Court said is trial court, in deciding whether there's a train of facts or circumstances that clearly tend to point, you can't then say, oh, there is that, but the state's evidence is so strong, I'm still not going to let it in, which is what the trial court did in Franklin.
So you could have something that met the requirements of ER, the 400 series evidentiary rules, but would not be admissible because it didn't meet the test of a sufficient train of circumstances.
I think they're one and the same.
You don't really need to read these cases as long as you're properly applying the 400 series evidentiary rules.
I think focusing on a reasonable doubt is unnecessarily looking at the state's case, which you're not supposed to do under Holmes and Franklin. You're just supposed to look at what is the defense proper and is proffer, and is it enough to be relevant? You're not supposed to then weigh it against the state's case and say, well, you know, here's what the defense has and here's what the state has, and then I think, because then this trial court really is putting itself almost in the standpoint of the jury, which is inappropriate.
So
I think we need to stick with the down standard.
To whether or not the state's proof is sufficient to establish that the defendant committed the crime.
I don't think you're even supposed to be looking at the state's evidence, except for as it answers the question whether the defense proffer. I mean, obviously the state's evidence might be part of the defense proffer as well. But you're not supposed to be asking yourself how strong is the state's case.
You're not supposed to ask that, but
no.
You are supposed to ask whether or not it goes to establish a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt.
Yes, if it's relevant.
Well,
yes.
If it doesn't establish a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt, it's probably not relevant, right? So, I mean, that's the question. Does the evidence tend to establish a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt? If it does, it's relevant, and it comes in.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
I don't think that formulation is very helpful, though. I think the Downs formulation is far more helpful to trial courts in making this decision, which can be difficult.
Well, so, are you returning to the idea that there's something in Downs in those cases that sets a requirement other than the requirement in the 400 series rules for admissibility?
No, Downs is a formulation of relevance when it comes to other suspects.
So it would be a formulation, but it wouldn't be the formulation then, would it? because it would be, we've agreed now about four times, I guess, that the 400 series rule controls, right? So it couldn't be a mandatory formulation, because then that might exclude other things that would meet the requirements of the 400 series rules but wouldn't meet Downs and those other cases.
I guess I'm just having trouble following your train of thought.
Let me ask this variation.
Okay.
If the state was prosecuting Mr. Angish,
yes.
Angish, and sought to admit the same motive, ability, opportunity evidence, would the analysis be any different than the analysis of the defense's proffer of other suspect evidence?
Yeah, I think if the state tried to prosecute Mr. Angish, it would be the prosecution would be dismissed under a NAPSTAD motion for the same reason that it doesn't come in this trial. You know, all they had, the only solid piece of evidence against Mr. Angish is that he was present at the scene. And the defense initial argument was that everyone who was present at the scene,
in the offer of proof, it says that he's a member of a rival gang.
He is not.
And that in the offer of proof, it says that he's the member of a rival gang. That was the state of affairs when the ruling was made. And that the decedent's girlfriend knelt over the decedent's body, looked up at Angish, and said, "Don't shoot."
The defense doesn't have a single witness that can testify that Austin Angish is a member.
Are you
of
saying
rival
that the offer of proof is insufficient? Is the
or
you
that
didn't
Austin
you didn't
Angish
brief that? Are you claiming
victim
that the offer of proof is insufficient?
Yes.
Is it legally insufficient for us to consider in evaluating the propriety of the ruling?
Yes.
A written offer of proof made at the time that excludes evidence.
Yes, because it doesn't say how they can prove any of those facts. You can't just, the defense attorney just can't say, "Oh, this is what I think." He has to say, "This is the evidence that I would present."
Was the trial court's ruling based on a finding that this evidence was unavailable, or was it based on, even if
no,
you got this evidence?
And in fact, the offer of proof came in after the trial court's initial ruling. So the offer of proof was sort of a motion for reconsideration. Let me just say, this court may think this is a close call, but this is not a de novo standard of review. This is abuse of discretion. And if reasonable people could differ, then this court needs to defer to the trial court who was there. And her decision was clearly reasonable. The only solid piece of evidence was his presence. And the motive evidence was extremely speculative, based on basically...
Wasn't this a case that was really just based on... There was no physical evidence. It was really based on the testimony of the state's witnesses.
Four or five eyewitnesses who testified that they saw the shooting.
And it's a credibility issue. If you believe these witnesses,
yes,
the guy's guilty. If you disbelieve them, or if you find some reason to doubt their credibility, then
yes,
it becomes a... It's a there's a reasonable doubt.
Yes. Yes.
And the court's ruling, did it not preclude the defendant from offering evidence that would cause a doubt about the credibility
no
of these witnesses?
No, absolutely not. The credibility was attacked vigorously and questioned vigorously. The only two, to answer your question to opposing counsel, the only two pieces of evidence I can see that were actually excluded was Austin Angish had a gun at the scene, and then his Facebook posts, which were somewhat ambiguous as to...
But the court did limit argument,
gang animosity.
The argument that the defendant was allowed to make. Do you agree with that?
Yes. The very beginning, if you look at the very beginning closing argument, the argument was basically one of three Mexicans probably shot the victim. And those three are potentially Austin, Angish, Joey Perdoza, or Santiago Ortuno Perez.
The offer of proof, actually, I was just looking at it, and there are two things that were actually allowed that were in this offer of proof. One was that Austin Angish was within several feet of Mr. Castro, and the other is Ms. Lascano's description of the shooter, but that's not the inference that you could draw therefrom. And nothing else that's in the offer of proof itself was actually admitted. The trial court did not cite to Franklin, even though it had been decided about 6 months before this trial here, and as Franklin...
The trial court ruled, with the assumption that it was excluding the evidence that was set forth, that was summarized in the offer of proof.
Yes, yes.
Was there any request for a remedy that the trial court exclude any of the evidence that was set forth in the offer of proof because the defense wouldn't be able to prove it?
No, they had the defense filed a memo trying to set out the background and how they would be able to prove these various things, and then said, it's, but then when the, after the court made its other suspect ruling, the defense says, well, all these things I want to prove, they're relevant for other suspect evidence, but I don't know that you're going to find them relevant for other reasons, but that they're all crucial to my other suspect evidence. And then the court just simply said, well, we're not, since you're not going to be allowed to introduce any of that, we don't need to worry about whether any of it is actually admissible. And the defense was trying to explain as well as it could how it thought it was admissible, this other evidence.
The reason for the exclusion was the reason that's been briefed.
Yes.
Not questions about the competency of witnesses, firsthand knowledge, whether anybody was available to testify to those things that were summarized in the offer.
That's correct. Yes. That's correct. And as Judge Spear was saying, the trial court's ruling, which is on October 23rd at page 77-78, was that the defense needs admissible evidence to establish a foundation that in order to be able to conclude someone else was the shooter and it was not Mr. Arturo Perez, which demonstrates, as you were indicating, that the court was requiring Mr. Arturo Perez to meet a heightened threshold, in addition to parsing this other the case law is demonstrating a heightened level of admissibility for this kind of evidence. And at the end of the day, Mr. Arturo Perez was precluded from his constitutional right to present a defense, to confront his accusers, and to make available argument to the jury, which are all constitutional issues that deprive him of the trial that he should have been allowed to have and requires reversal for a new trial. Thanks.
Thank you. Next up.